You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Setlist, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Taylor Swift, Spotify and Sam Fender. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last 7 days and a bit. A week when, well, everyone was recovering from Glastonbury, weren't they? I mean, not everyone, but everyone.
Well, what, 200,000 people on site, if you take all the staff and artists into account?
Yeah.
So 200,000 people were recovering from Glastonbury.
Actually. Yeah.
Unless you're suggesting that those who viewed it on the BBC had to recover
as well.
Yeah,
well, actually, I stayed up too late on Sunday watching The Cure and then a few bits after that, and then I was really tired on Monday, and then I've had a really tiring week anyway, so I do blame Glastonbury for that.
Is that why when I sent you a message through Slack, I woke you up?
That was Tuesday morning.
Was that Tuesday?
Monday, I worked solidly, not just on it, but I was busy solidly from 7 a.m. to about midnight.
Despite the late night.
That's why I was tired.
In order to watch The Cure's headline set.
Yes, well, but that didn't help.
So you watched all three of the headline sets?
I did.
Did you watch Kylie, who obviously wasn't a headliner,
but... I have not watched that because I was out on Sunday.
What do they call that late afternoon?
Legend slot.
The legend slot almost has become equal with the headline slots, hasn't it?
Weirdly, yes.
Since Dolly Parton, I think, it's sort of become... It gets as much attention and is sort of equated. You know how the big story was that Kylie was meant to play Glastonbury 14 years ago
14,
or something?
Yeah.
And obviously because she had the cancer treatment, she couldn't do it. Would that have been the proper headline set?
Yes.
It's okay.
Basement Jacks did it instead. I was there.
You were there
I think that was the last time I went to Glastonbury.
So it wasn't quite a replacement.
Wow, has that been 14 years? I should probably go again.
But it was, if we're going to equate the Legends slot with the headline slot. But we can't talk about the Legends slot because you didn't watch it.
No.
I didn't watch anything. Well, the only thing I watched is the thing that I think everybody in the world watched, which maybe we can come on to in a moment. But let's talk about the headline slots first.
Okay.
You felt that the whole proceedings got off to a very strong start on Friday evening, that it was going to be almost impossible to match, outperform on the following days. It does sort of feel in all of the reportage and coverage and commentary and online social chatter that there has been about Glastonbury, because it is still the festival everyone talks about, which I'm assuming is, I mean, obviously it is the biggest festival. It's the most famous British festival, but it's the BBC coverage that makes
it. That definitely helps it.
The big talking point. But it seemed to me by looking online, everyone talking, the country was basically split into two, between those people who felt that Stormzy's headline set on the first night was an awe-inspiring, groundbreaking, history-setting set that's possibly one of the greatest Glastonbury sets ever.
Yep, an uncontroversial view.
And then the other half are racists. So I think that's how we split the country in half. It's a Chili Gonzalez joke, really, isn't it? Extended for Glastonbury. But you were among the former.
I'm a non-racist.
You
were
non-racist. Because there were a lot of people in my social feeds.
I don't think you could argue anything. I mean, I don't know how anyone could argue that that wasn't one of the greatest Glastonbury sets of all time. He went all out. I think that's another thing about Glastonbury. I think partly it is because of the big TV coverage, but people put a lot of effort. Well, a lot of people put a lot of effort into their sets, particularly the headline sets. And he clearly put a huge amount of effort into that set.
Spent quite a lot of money.
Spent a lot of money on it.
Is it his money or Glastonbury's money? I mean, presumably they give him a set fee, and then what he does with that fee is up to him.
Yes. And he'd clearly spent
the whole fee.
All of it on his set. It was a set that had everything. It had grime, it had gospel, it had ballet, had costume changes, it had just a huge number of people on stage.
And it felt like it wasn't just Stormzy being tested by that headline set, because although, as you say, actually, creatively, it was quite eclectic, it did kind of feel like the genre of grime was being tested by being put in front of a BBC audience in a big top slot.
Yes, because although he incorrectly tweeted before the event that he was the first black British artist to headline the event, when of course Skunk Anansie headlined in 1999. And so that's quite a lot earlier.
They sent him a very polite correction tweet saying, "You're wrong, but have a brilliant time." And then he sent quite a nice apology back. So that was nice.
She wasn't worth, I think Skin was saying in an interview subsequently that when Beyonce headlined, they said it was the first black woman to headline Glastonbury. And she said, "Well, I didn't want to make a fuss of it, but obviously that wasn't true." And then she said, "Well, I mean, arguably Maxim from The Prodigy is a British black artist and he's a front man of that group, and they headlined in 1997, so she wasn't necessarily the first person." But ultimately she was saying, even so, it's great that Stormzy did that, I'm a big fan of his, but it shouldn't have taken 20 years so that everyone could forget that someone had done it before. But yeah, there was a big moment in the set where he just reeled off as many other grime MCs as he could think of, which was a lot. I don't
past
know.
Present and future.
Yeah,
he was sort of saying these are the artists without whom he could not have been here. So obviously it began with Wiley, because it has to begin with Wiley, but then he went through. And then he was sort of name-checking his contemporaries, a bunch of whom were actually playing other stages at Glastonbury.
And Dave and Fredo guested with him in his set as well, so
and
they were there.
Then he went through some newer names that he was sort of saying to his audience, unless you're a full-on grime fan, you may not even heard of these people yet, but you must check them out. I assume, I don't know this, I should have checked. I'm assuming somebody somewhere has now set up a playlist with all of those name-checked artists.
Yes, that is that has happened.
On the Spotify's.
Yes.
So you can go and check them all out.
Yes, but I mean, it was a very long list. It was a very, I mean, that was, you know, you can have lots of gimmicks in a set, but I think that's a feat of memory. That was quite impressive.
Unless he had it being fed into his ear.
I'm going to say he remembered. He did at the end say, "I'm sorry to anyone, I forgot, I didn't mean to." It was like, well, you can't be that many people left.
I did actually see that bit, although I didn't watch any of Glastonbury, I did see that bit.
Yes, but anyway, it was such a brilliant, brilliant set.
But what I was trying to say earlier, and I forgot, I think you cut me off rudely, was that quite a lot of people in my feeds were saying grime isn't for them, and so Stormzy isn't really for them, so they aren't big fans of those tracks just because it's not for them, but they still appreciated that it was an awe-inspiring, groundbreaking, historic headline
set. In the middle of the set, I did send a text to someone I knew who was there and said, "I really hope you're watching Stormzy," and he just texted back, "No, or you have missed out."
So that was Friday night, setting the bar very high.
Yeah.
So the other headliners, if we're discounting the Legends set because you didn't watch it.
And because it's not a headline set, really.
Technically, it's not a headline set. So Killers were Saturday.
Yeah.
And then The Cure were Sunday.
The Killers, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? Because they're not really promoting anything at the moment. They're just, I don't know, it was just there. And I've seen them headline Glastonbury before. In fact, I think they headlined Glastonbury when they only had one album. Which, I mean, that was one of the criticisms levelled at Stormzy, that he only had one album. How can he be a headliner? Killers had done it before on one album. It was fine.
That was Hot Fuss, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I loved that album when it came out.
And then I ruined it for you.
And then I met you.
Yeah.
Because I didn't meet you until after that. Mm. And you ruined it for me by pointing out how awful the lyrics are.
That's so bad.
So now when I listen to that record, even though it was, for me, the album or whatever year it came out, I listened to it so much. But clearly wasn't really listening to the lyrics. Because once you do, it ruins the whole thing for you.
Well, it's all right. I mean, the lyrics on that album, at least, aren't worse than the ones on any subsequent albums. I mean, he's not got better. But yeah, so they did a headline set. And I couldn't help thinking, I wasn't going to watch it. And then I ended up watching it. I think mainly because my mum texted and said, "Are they having sound problems or is he just not very good at singing?" And so I thought, well, now I have to check it out.
I think there were some sound problems, to be fair.
But
because it wasn't just the Killer set that people were saying that about.
But, I mean, his poor singing is another issue. I mean, it just, he sort of gets around it by just shouting occasionally.
Well,
singing.
That's worked for other artists.
It's a good strategy. But they came across, I'm not sure if it was just his shiny suit. I think it was just the performance. They came across like a really competent wedding band. Like, you'd pay top dollar to have them play your wedding. You wouldn't necessarily want them headlining your big rock festival. But, I mean, as a wedding band, great stuff. And a lot of their songs are kind of big wedding songs now, particularly Mr. Brightside, which they obviously closed their encore with. Their encore was basically proving that point. They did an encore that was exclusively made up of classic wedding songs.
So cover version set.
Yeah. They got the Pet Shop Boys on and did Always On My Mind, wedding hit. Then they got Johnny Marr on to do This Charming Man, another one, always a floor filler at a wedding. And then they finished with Mr. Brightside, the, like, now just, like, go-to wedding song, I think. like it's a song you have to have at a wedding. And so it was, it felt very weddingy.
Well, that was good. Saturday night.
Some people get married at Glastonbury, don't they?
It's a wedding night, isn't it? Saturday. And then, definitely not doing a wedding band set on Sunday night, was The Cure.
Yeah, The Cure. And that was great because it was The Cure.
The Cure doing The Cure.
Yeah, The Cure just did a, they did The Cure. That was what they did. They did a Cure, The Cure doing kind of a 90-minute set of stuff that they like doing, and then an encore of their pop stuff to appease everyone.
Yes, the couple of tracks that everyone else knows.
But it was really good. It wasn't anywhere near the production levels of Stormzy, because it was a band on a stage doing some songs. But that's all you really want from The Cure, isn't it?
Talking about them doing the couple of crowd-pleasing songs they have in their oeuvre. When I was at school, I could take or leave Cure. I did not like them, but I wasn't a huge fan. But I had a couple of friends who were like fanatical fans.
Yeah.
And I'm sure still are, and were probably tuning in. And I always used to like telling them that my favourite Cure song was Friday I'm in Love, which is actually true. And I used to bring that up quite often because it used to really annoy them.
Mine is Lullaby, which did get into the pop hits section. I think still counts as a credible. I mean, they're all credible, aren't they? I was stumbling around trying to suggest that any Cure song is not good. I mean, there are not good Cure songs, but
not the ones they played.
No.
They played the good ones. But by Sunday night, nobody cared about The Cure's headline set because, well, online something was unfolding that we're going to talk about shortly that had nothing to do with Glastonbury that kind of took over the entire conversation within the music industry for certain. Meanwhile, as far as Glastonbury was concerned, it was all about Alex, the kid that got up to rap with Dave.
Yeah.
Who became a global phenomenon as far as I can see.
Yeah, I saw that live. It was quite a thing. I switched over to Dave's set just as it was happening. That was quite a something that could have backfired, but actually ended up going really well.
Well, as I've seen various people remarking on the social feeds and a couple of blog posts as well, I think it was interesting. Given that what had happened on Friday night, it did feel like this was grime coming of age in a way and reaching a much bigger audience than perhaps it normally would. Not to say, obviously, grime has reached a pretty big audience anyway.
It's done all right.
But reaching an audience who would not normally be consuming that sort of music. But it did feel that because of Stormzy's headline set, and then, of course, a bunch of other grime artists were also playing key sets over the weekend, that any possible Monday morning look at Glastonbury and those grime artists glorifying knife crime and gang violence and all of that. All the coverage in the mainstream media was, oh, look at this white kid from Wells rapping along to Dave, name-checking weapons of choice and stuff. So it was completely changed the narrative into being, what a nice guy this Dave was, letting this little white kid get up on stage and rap along. So that was interesting, I thought. Although, I would say, I didn't see it live like you did. You saw it live on TV.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not suggesting that I went there suddenly.
Just to see Dave's set. But
I did say I switched over. Not switched over, like teleported.
While he did a good turn, didn't he? Well done him.
Yeah.
That was good. But what no one else has pointed out is, one of the reasons why Dave was able to pick him out, he was down the front, sitting on his friend's shoulders. And that's not something we should be encouraging young festival goers to do. I mean, the flags are there for starters.
I don't know at what point that happened, because he basically said, I want to do this track, but AJ Tracy, who I do it with, isn't here.
Oh, you think?
So I need someone to come up and do it with me. And clearly this kid is a big fan. And when Dave said, does anyone know the words? They all lifted him up and he just started rapping from the crowd.
Think it only happened at that moment.
So yeah, Dave's
we'll have to rewind on the tape. If that's if that's the case, that's fine, because also he does that at all of his gigs, doesn't he? He gets someone up to do...
Yeah, they're just not usually on TV.
They're just not usually on TV. So therefore, everybody at the front presumably knew that that was coming up.
Yeah.
So maybe you're right.
Yeah.
In which case, I take it back and I apologise to Alex. But if you're going to go to festivals, don't go down the front and then climb on your friend's shoulders so that people behind you can't see, was my point.
Yeah.
Because the flags are in the way to start with. Mm. Were there lots of flags there again this year?
Yeah.
The Glastonbury flags. Get rid of plastic bottles, but... Is it Reading that had a flag ban?
Yeah.
It's Melvin Benn who's down on the flags.
Yeah.
And I thought we.
Yeah.
But at Glastonbury, the flags remain. Anyway, we're not here to talk about the Glastonbury Festival.
No, we're really not. And now we've talked about it for a long time and we don't have much longer to talk about anything else because I've got to go. But
let's
this week,
talk about the things we're going to talk about.
Yes. We are going to talk about Spotify cancelling plans to allow artists to upload music directly to its platform, and how auto-playing promo videos on social media are affecting people with epilepsy. But first, we've known for, years it's been speculated about the US indie label Big Machine selling up to someone. And we've talked about who it might sell up to. And at times we've reported on how, oh no, now they're not going to sell. And then maybe they are. And then suddenly, seemingly out of the blue, Big Machine put out a statement saying, we've sold ourselves to Scooter Braun's Ithaca Holdings Company.
Yeah, the story broke in the Wall Street Journal, that popular music magazine. And as you say, Big Machine, independent label out of Nashville, majority of its roster country artists.
Yes.
And rumoured at various points in recent years that they were going to sell. And so many different companies over the years mooted as possible buyers, including Apple at one point.
Yeah.
For some reason, as well as the majors and various other tech and media companies. But in the end, went to a music business, but not a Sony or a Universal. But Scooter Braun, still probably best known as Justin Bieber's manager.
Yeah, I think so.
Even though, arguably, Ariana Grande has kind of, you say, surpassed Bieber?
Yeah.
Also manages Ariana Grande. And for a time, Kanye, which is going to become relevant in a moment. So obviously, veteran artist manager, has various other businesses behind the scenes, his own little record label, and then this holding company that he set up. Obviously, at one point, he was going into business with Troy Carter, still best known for managing Lady Gaga, even though he hasn't done that for a long time now. But that partnership all fell apart and got very acrimonious. But he's bought up a publishing company and he launched an investment arm, talking about going to invest in businesses where media and tech intersect. So he's been slowly growing this music business. And as of Sunday, we had it confirmed that as part of his group, from this point onwards, will be Big Machine, with all of the artists currently signed to that label and its catalogue.
Yes.
Which, of course, and this is one of the reasons why people over the years have been interested on who might ultimately buy Big Machine, includes every Taylor Swift album to date.
Yes. Now, is Taylor Swift happy about that? I'm sure you know already. No, she is not. She described this deal as her worst case scenario.
Yeah, so pretty much as soon as the world had caught up with the fact that the Wall Street Journal had broken the news that Scooter Braun was buying Scott Buschetta's Big Machine, Taylor Swift had already taken to her Tumblr. Who knew people were still posting things to Tumblr in some ways? Someone said this on my social feed yesterday. That's the biggest revelation of all of this, is that people are still posting to their Tumblrs. She took to Tumblr to say that she had had no advance warning of this. She was finding out when she woke up on Sunday morning and was checking the news media like everybody else, and that she was outraged that she had not been consulted. But more than that, if there was one person in the world that she did not want to be in control of all of her master recordings to date, it was Scooter Braun.
Yes, because, of course, she doesn't have a direct relationship with Big Machine anymore. She signed a new deal with Universal last year, although her last album, Reputation, was her last one contractually obligated to Big Machine. So she has not yet released an album for Universal, although her next one, which is coming out later this year, will be. But it does mean, I mean, she's been signed to Big Machine since she was 15. I mean, the company basically set up to sign her. So they've got a big catalogue of her music from when she was a country artist to her becoming the biggest pop star in the world.
It's only when I write about Taylor Swift in a context of her entire career, like this was, because we were talking about all of her albums to date, I sometimes forget that she began as a young, buzzy country artist.
Yeah.
And then suddenly reinvented herself as a global pop star.
Yes, and not, I mean, I think with some resistance from Scott Borchetta in terms of him wanting her to at least keep some foot in country. It was 1989 when she went full pop, and he wasn't entirely happy with it. But it had always seemed like there was still kind of a mutual respect in this relationship. It was still amicable. But what I think this shows is that that relationship did not end particularly amicably at all. And in fact, going back to her statement when she signed to Universal, which seemed very pleasant, now there are things in it where you think, oh, actually, that's a bit of a backhander against Big Machine. She appears to be saying something positive about Universal. It's kind of a dig at her old label. Anyway, so she had been signed to Big Machine for a long time, as we say. And so Big Machine has a big catalogue of her recordings, which, I mean, it's the biggest thing that the company owns by a long shot. She, in her blog, had various criticisms One was that she wasn't told about this deal before it went ahead. So like you say, she woke up on Sunday morning and found out the same way everyone else did. But also that it had gone to Scooter Braun, who she said has been subjecting her to incessant manipulative bullying for years, suggesting kind of that this deal was mainly done just to annoy her. She also said that Borchetta was well aware of her hatred for Braun, because any time he'd heard her say Scooter Braun's name, it was because she was either crying or trying not to. She was saying that she's long had issues with Scooter Braun. Scott Borchetta, well aware of it, and should have known that if at the very least he was going to go through with this deal, he should have made her aware of it.
Now, if you're wondering where the beef with Braun comes from, we don't really know, but the things that Taylor Swift referenced in her Tumblr blog was some of the antics of the aforementioned Kanye West around about his Life of Pablo album, which is when Braun was managing Kanye, which included the track where he referenced Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
The track was called Famous, and the lyric that referenced Taylor Swift caused a bit of a ruckus. And then there was a he said, she said argument about whether or not Kanye West had warned Taylor Swift about that lyric.
I mean, it's a very similar argument to this.
He was saying that they talked about it and she was fine. And then she was saying, he only talked about the first half of the lyric, not the second half. And I wasn't fine with the second half. Then Kim Kardashian joined in and leaked a phone conversation between Kanye and Taylor, which she said backed up Kanye's side. And all of that happened while Scooter Braun was in charge of the Kanye West business. Then Justin Bieber, like a month later, chipped in with a only slightly snarky Instagram post that was alluding to the ongoing Taylor Swift, Kanye West.
Yeah, and that was what she used in her blog post to as an example of the bullying that she's been subjected to by Braun, not Bieber. Basically, it was a screen grab of a FaceTime call in which you can see Bieber and then in the corner, Scooter Braun, Kanye West. And the caption on it is, "What up, Taylor Swift?" And she's saying, "Oh, that's Scooter Braun having a go at me." Now, Bieber, it was one of the first people to chip in after this post had been published.
The reason why this became a global phenomenon within a few hours was, first of all, we had the news, which was quite big news, and there were statements from both Braun and Borchetta about the deal. Then Taylor Swift pretty damn quickly got her angry blog post up. Then Justin Bieber responded, also on Instagram. Then Scooter Braun's wife responded. Then Scott Borchetta pretty quickly as well got his side of the story up on the Big Machine website.
Quite a lot of pop stars have come out on one side or the other.
Yes, either going with the Swift camp or the Bieber Braun Borchetta camp. And so within a few hours, this was a mega beef occurring online.
Yeah, it was like a mass pop brawl. We report on deals and acquisitions a lot. And it's very rare. I mean, I would say this has never been this dramatic before. This doesn't normally happen. Some people might be not happy about a deal, but this doesn't normally happen. But basically, Bieber was pretty much the first person to chip in following Taylor Swift's blog post. And he said, "Look, that post, that was all me. I was making a joke, which I realise is a bad joke and not nice. But Scooter didn't know anything about that when I posted it. And he, in fact, told me off for it afterwards. And he's always had your back. He's always been nice. You shouldn't be bad-mouthing him now. You shouldn't be doing this in public." And then he accused her of bullying, saying, you know, by posting that blog post, you would have known that your fans would go and bully Scooter. So you're the bully. But I love you. We all love you. Let's do this behind closed doors without any shouting.
Yeah, so that was Bieber's response. Meanwhile, quite quickly, articles were popping up all over the internet, which put the spotlight on how record deals work. And explaining the fact that a traditional record deal, certainly a traditional new talent deal, so the first record deal that artists will sign with record companies, whether they are majors or indies. I did see somebody post on one of my feeds this week about linking coverage of this, saying, "Oh, the majors are getting a bashing on the back of this Taylor Swift story." And it's like, well, you've not been paying attention, because Taylor Swift's blog was indie label evil, Universal Music coming to the rescue was the angle in the Taylor Swift post. So I suppose it's worth mentioning that traditional record deals, whether with an indie or a major, would result in the copyright in all of the master recordings that were created under that deal being owned by the record company. And in some countries, because the record company, once the artist is signed, organises all of the recording sessions, The label would be the default owner of the copyright anyway, but that's not true in plenty of countries. In other countries, something has to happen in the record contract to confirm that the label is going to own all the copyright in the master recordings. So in the US, record contracts masquerade as so-called work-for-hire contracts, because if it's an employment contract, then under copyright law in America, where somebody creates something as an employee, the employer gets the copyright. So it is pretty standard in most countries. A very small number of countries, actually, copyright law stops this from happening. Germany, most prominently. She should have done a deal in Germany. Yeah. That's what she should have done. But certainly in the Anglo-American markets, and plenty of other countries too, it is pretty standard that when a new artist signs to a record company, the record company will own the copyright in any of the sound recordings that are released under that contract, traditionally for life of copyright. Now, as we discussed, I think last week when we were talking about the whole Vivendi selling half of Universal thing, we are starting to see, because of the rise of the label services company and the distributors who work with artists as well as labels, we are starting to see a little bit of change on this. And certainly in the indie sector, Big Machine being an indie label, life of copyright deals are no longer the norm. So if you're an artist, even a brand new artist, and you sign to an indie label, yes, the indie label will probably want ownership of the sound recording copyrights, but for a period of time, not for as long as the copyright lasts.
Yeah.
Whereas major label deals, it is still very much the norm that the major will want ownership of that copyright for as long as the copyright is in existence. So in the US, that would be 95 years after release. So that is pretty standard. It is slowly starting to change. And so that's what a lot of these articles then spun into. Cobalt's AWOL jumped on it, saying, aha, we're changing all of this. And it is true. Record deals are slowly changing. New talent deals are slowly changing. Indie label deals have changed faster. Major label deals are slowly starting to change. But certainly when Taylor Swift was doing her deal in the mid-2000s, it was still the norm. New talent deal. Label gets the sound recording copyrights for life of copyright. And certainly in the 20th century, that was the norm across the board. Of course, there are some artists from the 60s and the 70s and the 80s who signed those deals. So the label got all of the rights in their initial albums under the first deal that they did, whether it was for a major or an indie. And as I always say when I'm talking about record deals in my training seminars, artists have to remember that those first three, four, five albums that the label gets under that initial deal, in return for the investment and the cash and the marketing the label delivers, are probably the best albums that artist is going to make.
Yeah.
There aren't many artists who crack it on album seven. Usually the first few are the best. Now, I suppose because Taylor Swift reinvented herself as a pop star, in some ways you got the classic country albums and then she started again as a pop act.
Yeah.
Remains to be seen whether the next album is of the same quality. But often you are, in essence, giving away, selling the rights in probably what will be the best albums you ever release. But as I say, some artists from the 20th century, you will know, have got their rights back. And it's like, well, how did that happen? And it's because you do that first deal with record company, you get the cash advance, you get all the marketing, the investment, the infrastructure that comes with a record deal. You give up all your rights, these days possibly for a period of time, traditionally for life of copyright. But the hope is that when that first deal is up, and now you're a superstar, so the negotiating power completely changes, the label will be desperate to re-sign you. And now, when you're negotiating the second deal, you can try and negotiate some of the rights back. And then maybe on the third deal, you negotiate more rights back. And by the time you've done a fourth deal, all the rights are back with the artist. And there have been a number of artists who have done that, and they're now back in control of all of their rights. And that was relevant to this whole debacle because Taylor Swift, at the start of her blog post, before laying into Scooter, was talking about how she desperately tried to get her rights back in those initial albums before she left Big Machine. And then there's a little bit of a disagreement as to what the conversation went like, because when Taylor Swift's deal with Big Machine came up for renewal, what clearly happened was, which is what you would expect, she talked about renewing with Big Machine, but also went and checked whatever opportunities were out there, ultimately signing with Universal, who had worked with Big Machine on the previous releases, so they already had a relationship there. And clearly part of the conversation when she was talking about, well, should she re-sign to Big Machine, was, well, if I re-sign, can I get my rights back?
Yeah.
And Big Machine returning rights was clearly on the table. It was clearly being offered, but there was a disagreement as exactly what that meant. So she is basically saying, yeah, they offered me the rights back, but in a completely unreasonable way. Whereas Big Machine are saying, we were incredibly generous. We offered Taylor Swift all of her rights back if she re-signed to us for a second deal. But she chose, despite that offer being on the table, to go and take Universal's dollar instead.
Yeah, she says that she'd for a long time been asking to buy back her masters or regain her masters in some way from Big Machine. And when it came to renegotiate her deal, she said, well, if I re-sign to you, I'd like all of my masters back. And they said, well, you can get your masters back, but one at a time. For you'll get them in return for each new album you release, rather than all at once. So it would kind of be like, you release one new album, you get your debut album back.
Generally speaking, once you're a superstar artist and you're going to be doing probably a licensing deal rather than an assignment deal, so you keep the rights but you allow the label to monetize them, and superstar artists have been able to do deals like that for a long time. But also, once you're a superstar artist, you're probably not wanting to do that longer contract. Mm. You don't want to commit to work with the label for the next five releases. So that would be a way of Big Machine saying, okay, we can't lock you in to lots and lots of releases because you're a superstar now and that's not going to work. But if we return your rights to you on a release-by-release basis, then now you have a vested interest in making this a long-term relationship.
Yeah, she's unusual in that actually her most lucrative albums come at the end of her Big Machine contract rather than the beginning. So it would take her quite a long time to get those back one by one.
If they insisted, that's a good point. If they insisted on doing it in chronological order rather than reverse order, yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, that would make things difficult. I mean, I think that's possibly why she then refused the deal and went to Universal, where she said they were letting her keep her master rights. But she's saying in her blog post, she went for that Universal deal where she had more control and had a better deal, but it meant walking away from those master rights that she wanted back from Big Machine. And she said she did that knowing that the company would eventually be sold, but not expecting that it would ultimately be sold to Scooter Braun, who is her nemesis, apparently.
I suppose, yeah, to clarify, what she was saying there was because in order to get her rights back under this proposed deal, according to her, she was going to have to work with Big Machine for the foreseeable future. Because she suspected that Scott Buschetta was going to sell Big Machine at some point in the relatively near future, which she was right to assume that, she was kind of saying she didn't want to lock herself in because she didn't actually know who she was going to be working with. And even if it hadn't been Scooter Braun and it had been someone she liked, it would have been a massive change. So one of the reasons why she went Universal was because locking herself into Big Machine meant locking herself into, well, she didn't really know what. That was why she went the Universal route, giving up her masters. But she feels like she wasn't treated fairly in all of this. Whereas in Big Machine's response, they were even screen-grabbing template agreements, insisting that they had treated Taylor Swift very well in the negotiations, and yet she decided to bugger off to Universal.
Yeah, so in his response to this, a blog post on the Big Machine website, Scott Buschetta said, no, we offered her the chance to take back not just her master rights, but all of her videos, all of the photographs that we own, everything. She could have controlled everything, and she chose to walk away. And then he was saying it's definitely not the case that she didn't know about this deal until Sunday morning because, well, I texted her on Saturday night to tell her about it.
And I thought it was interesting because, I mean, that's not really giving her advance warning, is it? Because she then said entirely believably that she checked the news before she checked the text messages that had come in overnight. But I thought it was interesting. Somewhere else in the blog post, he was talking about how when Taylor had decided she was going for Universal, he'd been fine about that and he'd been really nice about that. And then he sort of said, and when Taylor Swift sent me a text message giving me a few minutes notice that they were about to announce the Universal deal, I put out a nice statement about it, but that was sort of saying, see?
It did seem like I sent her a text message late at night and in retaliation.
At least I gave her a few hours notice rather than a few minutes. But he had another reason why he thought that Taylor Swift should have known about this.
Yes, he said, well, Taylor Swift's dad, Scott Swift, is a shareholder in Big Machine, and all the shareholders were informed that this deal was coming up and actually had to vote on whether or not the deal would be done, and they voted 92% in favour. So he would have known about the deal and would definitely have told his daughter about it. So she must have known, and it's just not believable that she had no idea at all.
Now, Scott Swift was definitely a shareholder, a minority shareholder, but a shareholder in Big Machine. We were already saying that, weren't we? Because we were chatting about this on Slack as this story was developing. And we said, well, wasn't Taylor Swift's dad a shareholder in Big Machine? Surely he would have known.
Yeah.
But, said a spokesperson for Taylor Swift.
No! I mean, they said it longer than that. But what they said was that, yeah, sure, Scott Swift, shareholder in Big Machine, that's no secret. And yes, there was a conference call for all the investors to tell them that something big was coming up. But he didn't take part in that call because to be on it, you had to sign an NDA with severe penalties if you told anyone about the deal. And so he said, well, if I'm going to sign an NDA that says I can't tell my daughter about some big change that's coming up in her future, then I'm not going to sign that deal and therefore I won't be part of that call. So he didn't know. And that's surely, I mean, I know there's a lot of surely they must have known in this case, but surely Scott Buschetta would have known that there was an NDA involved in that call and that Scott Swift therefore did not take part in it.
Oh, well, he knew Scott Swift hadn't taken part because Scott Swift has his accountant, I think, or his lawyer, a representative on the call.
Mm.
Because what Scott Buschetta was saying in his post was Scott Swift's representative was definitely on the call.
Yeah.
So surely his representative would have told Scott and Scott would have told Taylor. Although that's interesting, if there was this full-on NDA, that was Scott basically saying, I'd be fine with two people breaking the NDA.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that my business partners, when we do calls like
who agrees to anything in an NDA, really?
Immediately would break the NDA to tell Scott to tell Taylor. But who knows? He said, she said, he said, she said.
There is a great deal of that going on.
A lot going back and forth. And as you say, it has been interesting watching both artists taking side and then fan bases taking side in all of this. A record label got sold. An artist's catalogue was part of it. That artist ain't happy. I mean,
that is not a remarkable story in the music industry.
We could be reporting on that pretty much every week. We could have this on set list every edition. We could be talking about that scenario. Pretty much any artist who's been in the music industry for more than, 10 years, certainly 20 years, can talk you through a story of that ilk. Well,
yes.
Not every, but a lot.
But it's not usual that there are quite so many blog posts flying around making accusations.
But I'd say it is true, and we talked about this before on Set List, that artist and songwriter power when negotiating deals with labels and publishers has increased over the last 20 years, more so for songwriters than artists to date. But certainly in the indie label sector, artists are getting better and better deals, and we're slowly starting to see it on the majors' side. And of course, that's because there are now other options for artists, not if they want a massive, massive cash investment, really. But there are other options, because I'm sure Taylor Swift, like everyone else, has read her MMF Deals Guide.
Mm-hmm.
So she knows about all of the different options available to artists now. So artists and songwriters are, as I say, in some ways, agonizingly slowly getting better deals out of the music industry. But there are lots and lots of artists and songwriters still stuck on the old-fashioned deals and, well...
Or on both, in this case.
Or on both, in this case. And all of that got an awful lot of coverage in the news media this week. Almost more coverage than Alex from Glastonbury.
Still to come, why big flashy videos might not be such great promo for artists. But now, Spotify has abandoned plans to launch a direct upload tool for artists, which the streaming firm began piloting last year.
Yeah, you'll remember this. Last September, Spotify suddenly announced that very soon, artists would be allowed to upload their music directly into Spotify. And actually, when they announced it, they already had a pilot underway. There was a bunch of artists already doing it, which would mean, just like with YouTube and with SoundCloud, in order to get your music onto Spotify, you would no longer need a label, you would no longer need a distributor, a TuneCore or a CD Baby or a Ditto or a DistroKid or whatever. You'd be able to go into the Spotify system, upload your music and get it on there. And so that was the big announcement last September. Naysayers, that's us, immediately said, well, that's not going to work because, all right, artists have traditionally uploaded their music to SoundCloud and then YouTube separately before getting a distributor to get their music everywhere else. But if every single streaming service is going to move over to a direct upload, you need your music to be everywhere. I mean, it's true in plenty of European markets, Spotify is by far the dominant streaming service. But I mean, in the UK, you can't not have your music on Apple Music.
Yeah.
And in the US, even more so. And of course, there are countries elsewhere in the world where there are other services which are dominating. So you need to have your music everywhere. If every single service is going to have its own direct upload, that's a lot of hassle for artists. There is a reason why the music industry is set up, that we have these aggregators to get your music everywhere.
Yeah.
So clearly that's not going to work, we naysayers said.
Mm.
Then Spotify announced it had bought into DistroKid,
one
of the aforementioned DIY distributors. So then it was suggested that not only would Spotify allow people to upload music directly into Spotify, Spotify would then distribute that music through DistroKid to all of their competitors.
Yeah.
That didn't sound like a great idea either.
No,
but it did.
It didn't sound workable at all.
It did overcome one of our issues. So that all happened last autumn, and the word was that this pilot was going to continue. Artists could apply to be part of this pilot. Slowly but surely, more artists were coming on board that way. Eventually, it will be made available to everybody. And then, of course, because most people don't really read news stories, they just read headlines, I then started going to events where people started to say, well, of course, now Spotify have direct delivery for all artists. And it's like, no, they don't. They've got a beta pilot underway. It's not yet open. There was a story on the BBC website about, I can't remember what it was. It was something to do with some content that got up onto Spotify and there was some data. I can't remember anyway. Can't remember the details of the story. It was one of those fake music type investigations. But the whole angle of the story was, this is only possible now because Spotify have opened up direct delivery to everybody. And it was like, well, that's wrong twice, because A, no, they haven't. And B, you've been able to get your music onto Spotify through a TuneCore type service for like 10 years now. So everybody got that confused. But anyway, we can now all stop talking about Spotify doing direct upload, because the pilot is over, and as if this was some sort of YouTube music service, they're not going to put it live. They're shutting it down before it's even made available to artists at large.
Yes, they announced this last week. They put a very positive spin on it and said, oh, we're not going to do this because we want to put our efforts into other great stuff for artists.
Which is what YouTube said when they didn't put their first streaming music service live.
But, like I said, there are a lot of issues with a direct upload service like this. I mean, the ones you've listed, there's also the issue you mentioned there, like the fake artist thing. I mean, recently, there have been a lot of stories in the news about demos from artists being uploaded by people who don't actually own them. So like Rihanna and Ariana Grande and SZA all had tracks uploaded by people not associated with them. There were compilations of unreleased demos and tracks that were kind of floating around the internet, all put together in an album, and then someone uploaded them, either just to get that music out there because they were a fan, or probably more likely to try to earn some money off that, and they were uploaded under fake names, but eventually spotted. But Spotify has its list of preferred distributors, and a big thing on that is having systems in place to stop copyright infringing tracks from being uploaded to its system. And if you remove the distributor and take that all in-house, then suddenly that's your responsibility. And once it's the service's responsibility, then different bits of copyright law kick in. Could Spotify claim safe harbor protection if someone uploads an unreleased Rihanna track to its service, rather than saying, well, that's the distributor's fault, they need to take it down?
Yeah, and that was another thing that we raised when they launched this, is what happens, as you say, when people upload other people's music, as people have done to SoundCloud and YouTube ever since those services began.
Yes.
Obviously, YouTube in particular, but also SoundCloud, have had to build systems to deal with that.
Well, we talked recently actually about that track that had got into Spotify's viral chart, despite being an unofficial upload, and then got taken down. Noticed the other day, back in Spotify's viral chart again. So clearly people are just going and uploading it over and over again. And that's just like a verse of a track. So it's a problem, and it's a problem that is better. It's not a good problem for Spotify to have, but it's better for them if it's not their responsibility.
Yeah, so as I say, last September we were saying, well, does this mean now that Spotify are going to have to build their equivalent Content ID to stop this from happening? And of course, at that time, in Europe, the music industry was lobbying, ultimately successfully, to get the liabilities of websites that allow other people to upload music increased with the whole safe harbor reform in the European Copyright Directive. So it did seem like Spotify were going to open themselves up to a whole load of hassle. Also, there is the thing that if a big pop star demo was leaked onto Spotify directly through Spotify, that's a bigger story for the mainstream press than it went through some distributor that most people don't understand. So it did always seem like it was opening itself up to a bunch of hassle. Obviously, people assumed that the reason they were trying to do this was to reduce the power of the music industry, because the licensing deals with the majors and the big distributors are all coming up for renewal. And if they have a feed of music that doesn't rely on the traditional music industry, then maybe that will increase their negotiating power. But I mean, you'd have to get a phenomenal amount of music coming through your system. And even then, would it really? Because this is going to be DIY music. It's not going to be established artists. I mean, Spotify can try and do direct deals with established artists, but they're going to be expensive deals.
Yeah.
When it comes to DIY, even if you got hundreds of thousands of artists using it, millions of artists using it, it wouldn't have that big an impact on your negotiating power, because the superstars are still going to be coming to you.
Yeah.
Either through the labels or the big distributors or through expensive direct deals. So the possible benefits didn't really feel like they were ever going to outweigh the hassle. So therefore, actually not that big a surprise when they took to the Spotify blog to say, as you say, spinning it with a, oh, it was just a learning experience.
Yeah, so they said they'd realised after running this pilot that the best way for us to serve artists and labels is to focus our resources on developing tools in areas where Spotify can uniquely benefit them, like Spotify for Artists and our playlist submission tool.
Meanwhile, those artists who have been distributing their music directly with Spotify for the last 12 months...
Which is not a huge number.
Not a huge number. And presumably they had another distributor to get to all the other services, or they were using DistroKid via the Spotify partnership, in which case they could just shift over to DistroKid. So I'm assuming it's not going to be that big a problem. But at least everybody can shut up about Spotify entering the distribution market, because they now officially are not.
Yes, so that, I mean, that includes us.
Yes.
So let's shut up.
We'll shut up.
And finally this week, Sam Fender has withdrawn a video promoting his new single Will We Talk after a fan posted a clip of herself having an epileptic seizure as a result of it.
Yes, so this fan said that she follows Sam Fender on Twitter, and that this promo video had just popped up and started playing in her feed, and it had had a negative impact on her. And in a statement, she said, "Strobes in videos like this are an aesthetic choice. They are not essential. And when they're used in an autoplay promo video, artists are basically saying to people like me," this is her speaking, "people like her, that they aren't welcome to be their fans. Her only option is to mute or to block the artist that she loves, and that sucks, and she shouldn't have to do it."
Yes, so she posted like one short, few seconds video showing her lying on a bed having a seizure. She said, "This is one of many seizures I will have today as a result of this happening." And it's not like, you know, you might have initially thought, well, if you're going to go and watch videos, then maybe, you know, you should be more careful. Going to be devil's advocate here, but this is not the case. This is, it's become the, in recent years, the norm for videos to be posted in tweets promoting things rather than images, and those videos tend to autoplay. And a trend in music promotional clips of this type at the moment is for them to have a lot of flashing images in them. They're a few seconds, they're there to grab your attention quickly. And if you're just scrolling through your Twitter feed and a video comes up completely unbeknownst to you that suddenly starts flashing in your face and causes you to spend the rest of the day having seizures, and that is not your fault at all. And in fact, she called out, I mean, as well as calling out Sam Fender, she called out Troye Sivan as well, who also has a post on Twitter at the moment promoting a tour like this. I mean, actually, at the time of recording this, his video is still up. If you go to his Twitter page, it is the pinned tweet at the top of his page. And it was actually like reading this, like not entirely understanding what she was talking about, then going to Troye Sivan's Twitter page and just see like this video coming up and immediately start flashing my face. You can kind of go, oh, I see. Yeah, that's clearly going to be an issue for someone who has epilepsy triggered in that way.
And it was interesting once that post had been posted, and I think Sam Fender, who, to be fair, quickly responded, it was one of those things where it's like, yeah, this is a really stupid thing to be doing, but to be fair, it had never occurred to me as a problem. And we're all used to, aren't we, that when you do a show, if you have strobe lighting, you put lots of signs up to warn people.
Yeah.
And I think if you have
And if you release a music video, I mean, that's standard, it will come up with the caption beforehand saying, this video contains flashing images.
And also for videos of live shows, same thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you do a video of a live show and there's going to be strobe, you put that up. Yeah, we're kind of conditioned that we know that it can have this horrible impact on a bunch of people. So we're all conditioned to do that. But I must admit, it had never occurred to me, because you do sometimes see those videos popping up in your feed. As you say, it's there to grab attention. The challenge with content in feeds is, even if Facebook allows people to see it, is how are you going to grab the attention? And I suppose a lot of artists these days, they're paying Facebook, aren't they, to try and get that content in front of people. And yes, you want to do something that really stands out. And I suppose lots of flashing images is an obvious way to do that. But it's so bleeding obvious why we shouldn't be doing that. And I think that was almost what Sam Fender was saying in his response. He was like, oh my God, I'm really sorry. It just, this had never occurred to us.
Yes.
This is something we should be thinking about.
So he said, not only, yeah, I've taken down the video, but not only that, I'm going to start working to make the rest of the music industry aware of this, because it's not just him. It's pretty standard practice at the moment.
Which is almost one of the reasons why, although we don't have a great deal to add to this story at the end of Setlist, we sort of felt it was worth mentioning.
Yes, stop
because,
it.
Because as I say, it was one of those where it's like, duh, of course, this is something everybody should be thinking about. But just like Sam Fender, not that I'm involved in producing this kind of content, but I'm pretty sure even if I was, it probably wouldn't occur to me.
Yeah, so Sam Fender said, "Really appreciate you flagging this. We had no idea and took down the video right away. We're speaking with the wider team to make sure the music industry is aware and these kind of things don't happen again. So yeah, like I said, stop it now. Find another way to grab people's attention. Just put up a picture of people like kittens, don't they?
Cats!
Yeah.
I have posted two pictures of cats to my feed recently.
I noticed one. I haven't seen the second one. I'm looking forward to seeing that now.
Because where I work at home is on the second floor of a house and I have quite a big window. And since the window's been open because it's sunny, this cat keeps jumping in while I'm doing my stories. The only reason I'm mentioning that is I have noticed...
Yeah, because it doesn't seem relevant at all.
On my social feeds, a lot of people are liking those images who have never liked anything else that I've ever posted. I mean, normally I'm posting blatant plugs about CMU, I guess. But it's true. We all know
yeah.
that.
Yeah, okay, so...
No more flashing
just
lights.
Just cats.
Just cats, but not cats in rooms where their lights flashing.
Maybe if people have cats as part of their live show, then that would work.
You could, no strobes at live show
just
either.
No strobe, just cats all over the stage. And then you have an auto-playing video. It's just like you playing the song and there's loads of cats. And that would probably be more effective than strobes. And no one has to have a seizure.
Well, if we wrap up this podcast while you're doing all those tedious bits at the end, I'll go and give Sam Fender a call and suggest that to him.
Okay, well, that is it for this episode of Setlist. You can email us with any questions or comments or, well, pictures of cats at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk or tweet us, or in fact you can find us on many different forms of social media. If you look up the account Setlist Pod, or just, I mean, if you just search Setlist these days, that tends to find stuff, doesn't it? So do that. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.